Hello, I'm Oliver Wang.
And I'm Morgan Rold. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about a heat rock, an LP that leaves a hole in their soul, but in a good way. Today, we will be diving together into one of the greatest hip-hop albums to ever come out of Los Angeles, but also an LP that probably a lot of you out there have never heard, To Whom It May Concern by the Freestyle Fellowship.
Well, here I am in the middle of an open hand. My feet are rooted in an upright stand. What's my plan? I feel the fingers closing and I got enlightened by the chosen man. A little frightened by my...
Yo, so the album we'll be discussing today is a 27-year-old Libra. Born in Los Angeles on October the 8th, it introduced those outside of L.A. to Freestyle Fellowship, a group of prodigious wordsmiths whose frenetic delivery, out-of-the-box pacing, complete with twists and shifts and an assortment of styles, set them and this album apart in a sea of other releases in 1991. Their mission statement was clear. In the lead-off track from the album, they announced themselves as the microphone for those affected by, among other things, tyranny and institutionalized enslavement. They presented themselves as MD and the Sunshine Men, AC Alone, Peace, Self Jupiter, Jasumbi, and Micah Nine, darlings of LA's underground scene who'd been tested and perfected in Leimert Park in a cafe whose appeal was like the inner city song that says, "Let me take you to a place I know you want to go. It's the good life." To Whom It May Concern is canonical, seminal, and critical to any discussion about 90s hip-hop and how the West was won. Both our guest today and my co-host Oliver Wang have written about this album, and we all declare it to be, without question, a heat rock.
To talk about To Whom It May Concern, we invited one of the most important music and culture photographers to ever come out of the West Coast, Brian Cross, a.k.a. B+. You've seen his photography, even if you haven't always checked the photo credit, and you should always check for the photo credit. And he has created now iconic images for everyone from Old Dirty Bastard to Jay Dilla to DJ Shadow to Outkast, to countless more. He is the author of one of the first and best books about the history of hip-hop in L.A. It's Not About a Salary. And far more recently, he's finally published his first book of photography entitled Ghost Notes, Music of the Unplayed. B+, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Thanks, man. Super happy to be here. Honored.
I'll be very honest. I was very, not even that secretly, hoping that you would choose this exact album, partly because I'm a massive fan of To Whom It May Concern, but because it was released on an independent label in 91, and you know, very few people outside of LA really got to listen to it at that moment. It wasn't issued on CD even, I think, until 1999. While I have my own motivations for wanting to talk about it, I'm wondering, why did you want to talk about it?
I mean, I would have to say that this record probably this record changed my life, basically. I mean, very in plain, simple terms, this record, I was at Cal Arts. I was a young graduate art student in photography. And the great Mike Davis prompted me to go make photographs of hip hop. The first thing that I found was the Watts Prophets. Somebody introduced me to Amdi, and that kind of sort of blew one half of my brain away. And then I went to the Crenshaw Mall because I heard there was a guy there that had this tape and bought the cassette of To Whom It May Concern. And on the way home in the car, the other half just blew out the window. It was like the first hit. You know, it was like, I could say I've spent the rest of my life trying to, you know, have that feeling all over again.
I feel like with this album in particular, and especially given the people in this room literally right now, we need to give a little bit of a sense of place and a sense of time, which is, what was hip-hop like in 1991 in Los Angeles in that moment? And I mean, Morgan, obviously, this was your backyard, literally, right?
Sure, sure. We have to talk about what was going on in 1991 in terms of hip-hop. You know, to your point, the West Coast, you got Cypress Hill.
Here is something you can't understand.
AMG.
Bitch better have my money.
Oh, shit. Here we want a one, y'all, with nothing
around. It ain't nothing like black pussy on my dick. Word to the motherfucking DJ quick. I play O's like dominoes, slapping bones. AMG's on the motherfucking microphone. I sing dick, bitch, nothing more and nothing.
have to say Ice Cube, because I always think about No Vaseline in 1991.
Yeah.
Shout out. AMG, Yo-Yo. And so Freestyle Fellowship to come on the scene were markedly different than what was going on.
Sure.
And I think they were able to be that way because they were birthed, as I said in the intro, tested and perfected at the Good Life Cafe,
yeah,
which was this movement and this moment in time that's been immortalized in film by now, but was a place where stars were born and, and where we got this group.
Rules of the Good Life was not being whack. Don't be whack.
And the energy that was created by the place spread out sort of worldwide.
It became a thing where people were hearing about the Good Life all around LA.
You even had situations where, like, Ice Cube was saying, like, his dudes down there to videotape certain ones.
Shannon Doherty, when 90210 was huge, she was in the parking lot in the Good Life, and that's when you started thinking something is happening here.
I remember, and this is crazy, when Fat Joe got booed off of the Good Life stage.
If you could talk a little bit more about your knowledge of Good Life Cafe.
I found out about the Good Life through meeting Kilu from the Fellowship. And I remember going there the first time and being kind of disarmed by just how humble an abode it was. Tiny, tiny little health food store with a teeny weeny stage, which had, for some reason, like giraffes and some kind of safari scene painted in the background.
In the sort of the West Adams.
West Adams district, yeah.
And what was it about the Good Life that was so relevant to a certain community of L.A. rap artists in that era?
The thing about it is when you open up these kind of autonomous spaces that operate kind of from the ground up, like B. Hall ran the space, came up with the idea with her son, Arcane Blaze. But ostensibly, as long as you didn't cuss,
right,
it was open.
Right.
And when you open a space, you know, there was just very few places.
Mm-hmm.
And my argument's always been is that, you know, the black public sphere in L.A., which has been, you know, suppressed and suppressed and suppressed.
Least of all in that era. Right.
Exactly. And when you open up these little spaces, then there's just an extraordinary plethora of types of expression that start to emerge. And that find places like this as their home. And then these experiences kind of become legendary.
And I think the fact that profanity wasn't allowed is so significant when you think of hip hop today, which is so dependent on profanity, almost every other word.
For sure.
The Good Life Cafe encouraged you had to be dope.
For sure.
You couldn't rely necessarily on any expletives or anything like that nature. And those were rules. You'd get cut off.
For sure. Oh, no, she'd cut the mic. We all would cut the mic.
That's it.
And even if she thought, like, you were
getting
skirting
clear
the border, right, like
in the area.
Yeah.
I remember
Medusa at one point getting cut off for something that didn't have expletives in it, but Bihal decided it was just, you know, inappropriate, basically, you know.
For those that don't know Freestyle Fellowship, what do you see, if you know, are the distinct differences between the personalities? How would you describe the difference between Self Jupiter, AC Alone?
So the person that was the kind of obvious first person you would find when you would come to the Freestyle Fellowship, or the one that was most visible, was always Mike and Nine.
Running but naked, hysterical in the flames, miracles never claimed, captive, devious, dubious, doobies, doomed, damned in hell forever. Jump back, you crack breath, pepper, suffer heavy consequences in a harsh or marsh environment. Oblivion, wrinkled and racked up, rear intense, then to bubble like plasma, amoeba, placebo, black rain, fall, searing us all as I talk all. Thou not knoweth, ye have.
And Mike is an anomaly in the sense that Mike, really is a very, very original, very, very, I mean, they all are in their own way, but Mike's style, I remember the first time I saw Mike and I thought, I'm not getting this. This guy is not good. This sounds out of tune. I'm not sure what's going on here. And it wasn't until, you know, a few times. It took, you know, it's like, this is music that's difficulty music. He would tell you that, like, this is difficulty music. And so Mike was at that time, was this very elevated, very interesting cat.
Be advised, they'll come. Be advised, they'll come in. The wink of an eye, then the sun will shine no longer for anyone. Be advised, they'll come. Some are sure that they'll.
They're all street cats for the most part. I'd say AC is probably the least of in terms of the group. Then you have AC Alone. AC Alone, I remember they used to say he's the raver. He's the raver of the crew because I guess he used to go to a lot of parties. You wouldn't be mistaken in thinking that AC was the lightest of the crew by virtue of like Happy Birthday to Me, you know, right. You know that kind of style.
Happy birthday to me, happy Earth Day to we. I just turned 175,273,000 and I'm at my peak. A freak of the week, a straight tweak with a godly type mystique. So shots back, nanu, nanu, wanu, you and a abort. Distortion report, omit sort, a quit court, sports support, cut short, time warp.
AC's a very heavy dude as well. In terms of kind of traditional rules of rap and rapping at that time, AC was the one I think who had the clearest vision in terms of like the trajectory, the tradition. AC was that guy. He's a funny guy, if somewhat inaccessible sometimes. Jupe is the bear of the crew. Jupe's Ornette is his name. Very proud of the fact that he's named after Ornette Coleman. Mm-hmm. Again, a very interesting and unique style.
Buckle your seatbelt, you're in for the ride of a lifetime. Your mind, we incline the taste in case of sudden malfunction. Suction, caution, embrace your melon and your buckle. Constrict your gut muscles to scream your comet, vomit your love it, varmint, plummet, atomic. Drop, pop, pop, fizz, fizz, to whatever relief it is. It pops.
And then Peace was sent by Reggie Andrews. Peace is the Reggie Andrews part of the story.
A black cat was in the street. I heard a beat from my black Jeep. Her long went beat. Bang, I laid her in a seat. Walked away singing melodies. I just committed murders by the trees. Saw some bushes, so I took a piss. And you don't want to fuck with this.
Peace is the youngest also in the crew. I think he was like 17 when they made that record. Peace's vision is quite dark, actually. You know, in the crew, he's the one most likely to talk about, like, there's aspects of Peace that reminds me of, like, the Ghetto Boys in some respect. Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of weird dream where things are dark and people get murdered. Like, that's Peace.
Which is ironic for someone named Peace.
Right.
Right.
Kinfolk. Matula Zeza. Peace. That's his name. Full. Just a sort of historical point. If you look at that first compilation called NWA and the Posse, there's a rapper on there called Microphone Mike, mm-hmm. and it is the same guy.
Right.
And the story at the time was that Mike was beaten up really badly and had a lot of damage done to his skull and had, in the sort of reconstruction, he had a metal plate put in there. And that when Mike came back, Mike's style then was different. And then, you know, this was something that had occurred through the accident, through him sort of relearning himself or whatever. That's the sort of mythology around Mike, yeah. Because he didn't sound like anybody else.
Right.
And I think it would be a mistake to say that it's entirely on Mike. I honestly believe that those times, the thing about that period that's so unique is that in that kind of a small autonomous space, everybody elevated everybody else's game. Fellowship to me was always dope because they always said things. They always meant something. You know, it never was like just rhyme dictionary, keep turning the pages kind of a situation. It was, you know, they were always trying to tell you things. The introduction of the record is kind of like, it's one of the great manifestos really you could have to me. But he says, acknowledging rap as an art form.
Right.
We break the rules and set new standards.
In by experimenting in tonal and harmonic inflections, sporadic pitch changes and deliveries. We'll stir your emotion and take rap music to its threshold of enlightenment. And beyond the shadow of a doubt, my brethren and sister, we came here tonight to blow up.
We came here to blow up. I mean, it's like... I'm like, yo, can we fund this? Like, where do we get the grant? Like, what? And this is the, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
I mean, it's such a hell of an intro.
It is.
And, you know, I've listened to this album countless times over the years, but even just revisiting it to get ready for our taping today, it still is so mind-blowing that this is their manifesto at the beginning of the album in 91. And I think, to be fair, you know, in the early 90s, there is a lot of this kind of experimentation going on. It's not like this was some kind of creative wilderness. Of course, I mean, hip hop had already been past its Rakim moment, right? Lyricism as a term, as a concept, had already well been underway. But even then, thinking about what they were setting out to do, all the things that they say on this album, including with that intro, as B's pointing out, it's just astonishing how clear their vision is and how much they wanted to just, you know, slap their hand down on the table and said, this is what we're about. Yeah. Brian, in your book, it's not about a salary, which, and I'm probably the billionth person to say this, you need to put it back into print because it is such an important history of LA hip hop in a moment. And obviously it hasn't been updated in, you know, 25 years, but nonetheless, I mean, it was a massive accomplishment when you first put it out. Any case, in the book, you write about how the Fellowship exemplified Los Angeles in a, quote, post-gangsta, unquote, moment. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, as they point out on in the song Sunshine Men.
Recently, I've seen MCs coming through while I was at home on my couch watching the boob tube, fighting like a roughneck just to stay loose as I sat and wrote rhymes on a page like Mother Goose. This was the problem, results of a test. The heart of all whackness lies rooted out west, right smack dab.
The sort of strongest argument, I think, that people felt at that time about the kind of social realist version of Los Angeles that was existing in Cube, gangster rap,
NWA,
with
right.
Cube, NWA,
MCA, yeah.
Was a kind of poverty in terms of poetry,
yeah.
Really. And that was the argument, really. I mean, and, you know, in their own way, and especially amongst a lot of the cats from the Good Life and even Blowed afterwards, the influence of that kind of music began to show. Like, Volume 10 is really a good example of, yeah, this. Pistol Grip Pump,
yeah,
obviously as a kind of a gangster classic, but then made by somebody who came from that tradition. Bone Thugs and Harmony is another group that come from, you know, that ends up in a kind of social realist trajectory. But that the argument of To Whom It May Concern was, is that they were neither L.A. Electro a la L.A. Dream Team, Uncle Jam's Army, or were they this sort of East Coast Pollution, which you can fill in the blanks there if you know the history of it. But there's a number of MCs that were out here at the time that had some success that had come here from the East Coast. Or were they, you know, people turning street money into rap money? They were coming from somewhere else. And that somewhere else is somewhere very, very powerful.
It's interesting because on Sunshine Men, they make a reference to radio and sort of the demise of radio.
I got the scoop on radio. It's all about your cash flow. Paper, airplay, or you fly solo. Only one brother can come up off this. Those without talents but big drug profits. Rap becomes a tool often used in vain, just like a gun, when they want out of the insane lifestyle. But they want.
I would also say that to me, the record is very much, it's the beginning of 91. I think, you know, that period, my memory of it was that there was zero, like, besides Mike Nardone and Rob One, there was no hip hop on the radio in Los Angeles.
It was all Bay Area.
Yes. Yes, for sure. And I mean, that's why places like The Good Life as a portal to potential are so important.
And the other place in which radio comes up, or radio becomes a theme, is in the track Dedications, where at the end they say, and as a band, we'd like to dedicate this entire LP to the loss of our radio station, K-Day. I don't expect it to be precious necessarily to those outside of LA, but it was huge for the community. And just like the Good Life Cafe was responsible for a lot of the, you know, the growth and the flourishing, certainly radio was too.
And as rappers, the entire Freestyle Fellowship would like to dedicate this LP to the loss of our only rap station, KDAY.
We'll be back with more of our conversation about Freestyle Fellowship's debut album from 1991, To Whom It May Concern, with our special guest photographer, Brian Cross, a.k.a. B+, after a brief word from some of our other fine Max Fun podcasts. Keep it locked.
Going into a Bullseye interview, I know it's somebody who does amazing work, but it's an actual conversation. I don't know where it's headed.
Hey, this is the straight talk that you're going to get on this show.
Does that make sense? I feel like I'm in therapy.
I think I got more out of you than the therapist I went to twice.
Bullseye. Creators you know, creators you need to know. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Allegra Ringo.
And I'm Renee Colbert. And we host a podcast called Can I Pet Your Dog?
Renee, can I tell you about a dog I met this week?
I wish that you would. In turn, though, can I tell you about a dog hero?
May I tell you about a dog breed in a segment I like to call Mutt Minute?
I would love that. Could we maybe talk about some dog tech?
Could we have some cool guests on, like Lin-Manuel Miranda, Nicole Byer, and Ann Wheaton?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
I'm in.
You're on board. What do you say we do all of this and put it into a podcast?
Yeah, okay.
You think? Right. Should we call it, like, I don't know, Can I Pet Your Dog?
Sure.
All right. What do you say we put it on every Tuesday on Maximum Fun?
Or on iTunes. Sounds good to me.
Meeting's over.
We're back on Heat Rocks, talking about Freestyle Fellowship's debut album, To Whom It May Concern. And our guest today is photographer Brian Cross, a.k.a. B+, who's got a new book out. His first book of photography, including many, many musical, but not just limited to musical figures, called Ghost Notes, Music of the Unplayed. Morgan, I know you wanted to get a little bit into the jazz elements of this, because that is obviously a huge part of both the fellowship in general, but also on this particular album.
Well, I'd have to talk about 5 o'clock Follies. You know, in preparation for this, I listened to it again. I hadn't listened to it in a while, and I had to listen to it again. And just as an experiment, it was late. I thought, let me just play around with this a little bit. So I actually, because it reminded me of Ornette Coleman, so it's interesting that you've brought up Ornette, I thought, let me play around with it. So underneath 5 o'clock Follies, I played Humpty Dumpty. And it was interesting how much it made sense, how good it sounded underneath.
Are lurking within the nooks, saying crannies and crevices, such credible edifices and books in the president's presence. We have the evidence, and it's evident that this was a robot and so was a first lady, and a whole lot of souls sold to the devil. On the level the government is.
So I was just struck by the similarities in tempo. Certainly that's free jazz, but there's a lot of jazz on this album. You certainly have bebop, you've got fusion, but this is free jazz. So I wanted to talk to you about the influence of jazz on this album.
I remember going to meet them in a house in some, I was in Inglewood or somewhere. I was new to the city at the time myself, actually. And I had been, worked as a furniture mover in San Francisco and spent a lot of time listening to the first Gangstar record, particularly listening to the song Manifest, which has a sample of Night in Tunisia. And thinking about this notion of a kind of continuity or a set of continuities that existed between this music and the previous, you know, between and jazz, it was kind of a key. It was a key question. And the thing about To Whom It May Concern and the thing about meeting the fellowship was they just cut to the chase, which was that they understood precisely that jazz already had vocalese traditions. When I met them, they, you know, they were already listening to John Hendrick's Freddie the Freeloader. Freddie the Freeloader, for those of you that don't know, by the John Hendrix version, actually wrote out all the solos by everybody on the record and then put words to the solos that was able to sustain. Mm. So in terms of notes, they were following, you know, what Cannonball and what everybody had played on the Miles record, but they were actually had put words to it. You know, and this is entirely down to the fact that, you know, the fellowship was an amalgamation. And as part of that amalgamation was Daryl Moore, or JMD. And JMD is a little bit older than me. And JMD was a kind of bridge to that world from somebody who'd been thinking about it for a long time. So it wasn't just like, oh, we found it in our pop's record collection, right, and we decided to loop it up. We don't think of jazz necessarily often in terms of vocalese. Vocalese is a kind of transcriptive kind of practice or whatever, as opposed to the great jazz singers, which sang like instruments.
That's what Micah Nine sounds like to me. There are places on this album where I'm like, yo, is he scatting? Because that's what it sounds like.
He's scatting. But there's examples that go back to, you know, signifying. This goes back. There's all kinds of things, but the notion of that kind of improvised practice for me as somebody coming from Ireland, like, whew, I was, yeah.
And this to me is what pushed them over the top. It would have been enough to be that dope lyrically, but to be that dope lyrically with that type of timing, I hadn't heard before, and I don't know that I've heard since. It just cast them in a category all by themselves, particularly where it comes to Mike and I.
Well, I certainly think of Kendrick Lamar in terms of the alacrity and just the complexities of his rhyme scheme. And I had always assumed, just because he's a, you know, he grew up in Los Angeles, that he would have grown up listening to Fellowship, given the kind of musical similarities and parallels. The fact he's working with some of the same personnel from that Good Life early 90s era on something like To Pimp a Butterfly. But apparently, and this is, I got to give a shout out to my man Nas, Andrew Nasnitsky. He was like, no. Like he's, and many people pointed out that when they've interviewed Kendrick, like he did not grow up listening to Fellowship because that was like old. That was old music to him.
So this is new information for me because I would have thought that he had listened to the album and had been influenced, especially on songs like Free, I would have thought.
Yeah, and I think Brian mentioned this before we taped, is that it may not be a direct one-to-one lineage, but the people that the Fellowship influenced someone else who eventually influenced
Joseph Lineberg. Right. I mean, Joseph Lineberg, who was part of the group Madcap, who's a trumpet player, who's at CalArts with me, produced How Much Is a Dollar Worth and was in the studio and was very close with Terrace Martin.
Yeah.
Just because there's no direct, just because you didn't hear John Coltrane doesn't mean you weren't influenced by him.
It's in the DNA.
It's in the...
Sorry.
I see what you did there. And you got Kamasi on there, you got Terrace Martin, you got Glasper, so you got the jazz heads on there.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
So
let's bring this back to Whom It May Concern. B, what is your fire track off of this LP?
Oh, man, this is too hard.
I know.
You know, while they were still working on Inner City Griots, the kind of go-to place after The Good Life became the Farside Manor. The Farside got this house on Bundy, and we used to all go over there afterwards. And there'd be like 30 or 40 people there, somebody with a cassette deck playing instrumentals, and people just kind of getting into it, smoking a little bit, drinking a little bit. And we never got hassled. It was a kind of an after spot for The Good Life. And I saw things there in that period in terms of this tradition, in terms of jazz, and in terms of like how, you know, I saw freestyle sessions where people were all rhyming melodically, where more than one person was going at the same time. Mm. And, you know, I didn't have a video camera or I didn't even have an audio recorder, but things that I saw in that period that have, you know, avenues that seemed extraordinarily fertile that never were investigated. I was lucky enough to see Billy Higgins and Horace Tapscott play with the Freestyle Fellowship. Mm. You know, people were aware, you know, lots of elders came, Ben Caldwell, you know, Kamau Daoud, great, great people, important figures in the history of black arts in Los Angeles came and understood what was happening with the Freestyle Fellowship. And Convolutions was kind of the door to that for me. That was just like the explosion went off in my head. And it's not a track, you know, it's kind of an awkward answer, but
no, but
that that's the one for me.
Yeah.
A-C-G-G-G, a-cha-cha-cha, ooh, you got another one to get you where it gotcha. Ooh, me, ma, wow, you got another one to get you where it's caught. Please grab the 40 and pour on a high contour, and go for more on the shore in beds for reds and nets and nets, get some of this synopsis. Next up is a bomb coming at ya. Compose the complex rhymes, another batch to start around Eclipse straight.
What about you? You love this album. What's your fire track?
Well, we had talked about Sunshine Men already, and to me, that's a song I keep coming back to. Part of it is the production of it. But in terms of, if I had to pick a song that I thought really captures the essence of this album, and there's many different looks on it, so it's hard to reduce it to just one, it'd be Seventh Seal.
Mm, yeah, that's my fire track, too.
Pure Black Whirlwind, to me, just captures the energy and the essence of what Fellowship was trying to do on this album.
Be advised, they'll come in from a sky kingdom. Hear the trumpets and then be advised, they'll come from a pure black whirlwind. Be advised, they'll come. Be advised, they'll come.
This track just has so much appeal for me on so many levels. First, the biblical appeal, okay? Seventh seal, the last seal that contains details about the second coming of Christ, and it hints at trumpets. So he just starts out to me so Old Testament. It's like being in school. It's like diversified curriculum. You get your Old Testament studies. By the time he starts talking about quasars, you're into astronomy.
Right.
His delivery is just, how can you say all that and get that deep? I mean, it is certainly an exercise in lung capacity. this guy is super gifted, but so on point. And what I like about the beginning of the song is, to me, he sounds like Gil Scott-Heron, sort of singing. You know, he's not the prophet or the son of a prophet, but he sort of sounds really prophetic on it. It's a warning. It's a whisper in your ear. Be advised, they'll come. I mean, it's just, I could go on and on. I could gush about it. But for me, to your point, it is classic and quintessential Freestyle Fellowship and what they were about. So we know what your favorite track is. What is the sleeper track on this album?
Besides the whole album being a sleeper.
Yeah, I mean, the whole record is beyond sleeper, of course. Okay, so this is this is a tricky question. The song that I was surprised by, let's put it that way, going back and re-listening to this record all these years later, which I, for whatever reason, didn't remember, but seems just extraordinarily pertinent today, is Legal Alien.
Why are you an alien?
Because I'm treated like a Klingon. I get stabbed in the back as I'm beat on by these non-natives. They call me a trespasser. I was first on the planet, but now I'm last on the poles of progress. Check the latest figures. The average black, nothing but a house nigga in a permanent...
I mean, there are so many things about this record to me that are, you know, I don't know whether to feel bad about this, but the politics, we're still stuck with the same... We're still stuck with corrupt police. We're still stuck with bad border policies. We're still stuck with a whole mess of things that impact more on the lives of those, you know, at the sort of at the fringes of the sort of economic pyramid.
Absolutely.
And Legal Alien, you know, it's kind of a proto. It reminded me a little bit of Gangstar. You know, it's a kind of Gangstar-esque kind of song. But lyrically, you know, what they're talking about and what they're alluding to just seems extraordinarily pertinent. And for whatever reason, I didn't remember it. I did, you know, it was one of those songs that I, you know, when you say To Whom It May Concern, it's not a song that I would have remembered. But listening to it the last few days, I was like, oh, wow, that's actually really cool. It is a very political record. Again, I think, you know, for folks out here, we remember it as this kind of moment of liberation.
We will not tolerate your gates. Hate, beats, blacks, creates, mistakes, false facts. Fuck that, get my gas. From under my axe, surprise, wait, don't wait.
And Daryl Gates' name, you know, who was the police chief of the LAPD at that era, he keeps
and
coming.
And wasn't a household name unless you lived in Black Los Angeles,
right.
To be honest.
Not in 91.
By 92, obviously,
right.
We all knew.
Yeah. Right.
But in 91, you know.
They were real woke in 1991.
Yeah. Before woke.
Before woke.
Before woke.
Before the city burned.
Proto woke. Morgan, what's your sleeper jam in here?
Jupiter's Journey.
Soaking and poking in a liquid light substance. I'm gonna fall drown. Look around in a cord is attached and a hatch. There's a light, but I might sit and ponder a while. I'm under a pile of pressure with sounds like I'm over a turnpike. Yikes, Geronimo. Look out below, plumbing and fast. No more pain and laugh. Life's a game. My past can ask questions.
I'm a fusion junkie. And so they get extra love for the weather report sample. But I love the flow. It's adjusted. So to me, it's precious to me. It's a sleeper because people don't talk about it.
And I think Jupiter of the batch, I mean, AC and Mike had, I think, the most prominence coming out of this. And Jupe is always there in the background. And he's kind of like the sleeper artist maybe off of this thing.
Yeah.
Brian, if you had to choose a song off of here that you would like to see a contemporary artist tackle and cover, and, you know, rap covers are a kind of thing, but not as common as other genres. But what would you like to see someone tackle? Who would tackle it, and what song would it be?
Going back to the conversation we had earlier, look, Kendrick needs to do a Freestyle Fellowship cover. And I would say, yeah, I can imagine Kendrick doing Seventh Seal. That would be, something fitting.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, I worked with Mos Def for the artwork on Black on Both Sides. And it was the first time, actually, I had a proper conversation with somebody from the East Coast that was maniacally a follower of this period of West Coast hip hop. And we talked about how, you know, in kind of almost like Smithsonian terms about how this period needed to be documented properly. It needed to be a box set. It needed to be annotated and proper liner notes. And this is before Genius and all this other stuff. But I still agree. I still feel like that this is a period that's sort of radically underappreciated and that's been extraordinarily influential. And so, yeah, Kendrick, come on. We ready.
So we ask this of all our guests. It's difficult for you writers, you and Oliver, scholars, but if you could, it's difficult to answer this question to press it down into three words, but if you had to describe To Whom It May Concern in three words, what would they be?
Open, liberated, and enlightened.
That's it.
That was good. He just came off the dome real quick with that.
He did.
In the tradition.
That will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, B+, a.k.a. Brian Cross. His new book, which collects over 25 years of his photography, is Ghost Notes, Music of the Unplayed. B, thank you so much for coming through. Where can people find you?
Mochila.com. That's M-O-C-H-I-L-L-A.com. I'm there.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Morgan Rhodes, and Oliver Wang. Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess Uno of People Under the Stairs. We want to shout out Thess for hooking us up with that track. Heat Rocks is produced by myself, Oliver Wang, and Kara Hart. And today's show was engineered by Denny Barwella. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and executive producer is Jesse Thorne. We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their super cool studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Heat Rocks Pod. You'll find a link to our Facebook group on our webpage, heatrockspod.com. That's where we'll post show notes for every episode, including a track listing of everything you've heard today and more goodies. Again, that's at heatrockspod.com. And we would also like to shout out some folks that have been giving us love via tweezies and retweezies. We do so much appreciate your support. So we want to shout out Squid Meat. Appreciate you, Squid. Also, Tasty Quiche, thank you so much for putting us on your radar. Tasty Quiche of Bonfire Radio, General Peters, Solo One Love, and many, many more. Thank you so much for your support. And as always, if you have your own personal heat rock and want to share it with us, hit us up on Twitter or on Instagram. Good to see you all.
Good to see you too, Morgan. And just one last thing, we want to give you a sneak peek at next week's episode right now. If you had to pick one song off of here that is the fire track, which one would you pick?
Oh, you ain't right. You ain't right, Oliver.
I know.
I would say Butter.
It's cold.
And when I found that record, oh my God. I was heading for a thing and I didn't know. I felt spiritually connected to it. Like I was like, I think I'm going to go through this. And I related to it a lot. Butter. It's like Butter, baby. It was just him talking about like how life was for him, and it felt like they were people that I looked up to. They were much older than I was, but they molded who I was as a kid.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.